What I want to talk about today is that although these weapons which we are stockpiling and which we talked about last night are not being used, they are creating a very negative dynamic in our society, what I call a dynamic of death. I want to try to talk a little bit about that. Dynamic of death in three areas. I call those three areas an economics of death, a politics of death, and a psychology of death. And I want to explore those areas in terms of the death dynamic which is set off by the arms race with you today. Beginning with the economics of death that is released by the arms race. I pointed out last night that the cost of producing these weapon systems is enormous. The last Carter budget that was enacted by Congress in 1980 called for an expenditure of $160 billion on defense. But the last budget that Carter submitted, which was not actually accepted by Congress, but rather was revised by Reagan, called for an increase 3 to 5% in defense spending. So this military buildup, which we're talking about, was already underway or beginning under President Carter from 160 to 170 or 171 billion. But President Reagan, when he took office, withdrew this budget and added another 8 billion to it. So in his first year of office, the requested amount for arms spending went from 160 to 178 billion dollars. In fiscal 1982, it would have been. But as I said last night, the projections of the Reagan administration call for moving from that 160 billion to 422 billion by the end of the first term in military spending. When I was at this conference in Washington in February, the original estimate of 367 billion had just been revised upward to 422 billion as the final figure for the last year of President Reagan's first term. The original estimates were that during those 4 years, the government would invest $1.6 trillion in arms. But while I was at that conference, sponsored by the Center for Defense Information, which is organized and run by retired admirals and generals, the Pentagon announced that there had been a miscalculation that, in fact, the total to be expended during those 4 years would probably be $750 billion greater than was originally mentioned. So that means that instead of investing $1.6 trillion in those 4 to 5 years, a total of $2.4 trillion would be invested. Now, from 1945 until 1980, approximately $1 to $1.5 trillion were invested in arms spending. And in 4 years, that amount is to be exceeded. These are enormous changes and enormous demands on the nation's wealth, on the nation's resources. What that amounts to is moving the amount of our federal tax dollars which go to arms spending from approximately 50%, which is what they were when the present term began, to something like 70%. At the end of that term, so that 70% of all the federal tax dollars which you and I pay would be used for defense spending, for arms, either to pay for past wars, to pay the interest on past war debts, or to produce weapons for future wars, or to pay salaries in the military, or pensions in the military. That figure, that percentage, is arrived at by excluding the trust funds over which the government has administrative but no appropriational power. That is, that excludes government pensions and Social Security funds and funds of that sort, because the government does not appropriate those funds. Those are really annuities that the government holds for you and me and simply administers. If you take that part out of the budget, and it was reckoned separately until the administration of President Johnson, then we come up with those figures of somewhere around 70% of the remaining tax dollars used for war. One of the reasons many people feel that President Johnson grouped the Social Security and other trust funds in the federal budget was to minimize the cost of the Vietnam War and to minimize the percentage of tax dollars going to arms. It seems to me that what we have in the present administration is a very determined and consistent policy with regard to arms buildup. It was thought up through the administration of President Johnson that the country was rich enough to provide bread and arms without limit. So President Johnson, at the same time that he was escalating the Vietnam War, was also declaring war on poverty and expending enormous sums in both areas, namely defense and domestic programs. And those domestic programs were not as much of a failure as some groups have made out. And if you read your Global 2000 report, you will see that they did have considerable success in reducing the number, the percentage of people who were under the poverty level. I was quite impressed the night before last when I read that, at the significant decline in percentage of people who lived under the poverty line. But it became evident, I think, toward the end of the Johnson administration that the resources of the country were in fact limited, and that the country could not go on indefinitely spending unlimited funds, both in terms of human service programs and in terms of defense. We are dealing with a society, even one as wealthy as the United States, which confronts limits. Those of you that heard Walter Stewart's talk yesterday will have already thought about the fact that we human beings, individually and I think socially, in terms of our societies, are limited. It's rather surprising, given his history as an anti-communist crusader, that President Nixon's policies showed considerable restraint, I think, in military expenditures. His anti-communist rhetoric was not always translated into policy. He was, in many respects, the initiator of detente and did, in fact, manage the breakthrough with the Chinese government. And there was an effort under both Nixon and Ford, I think, to restrain spending both in terms of domestic programs and in terms of the military spending. Carter, by the time Carter went into office with the idea, with the promise to reduce defense spending, and I personally think he was sincere, but there was enormous pressure generated in our society, largely, I think, by right-wing political and economic groups, and also by the military, what President Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, military contractors and so forth, enormous pressure and enormous amounts of money invested in media and other campaigns to convince the American people that we were, in fact, way behind the Russians, and that was what was required was a great increase in the amount of money we put into military. And at the same time, there was an effort to bring into disrepute all of these domestic programs aimed against poverty and devoted to the furthering of education and all those kinds of things. President Eisenhower, in his farewell address, you remember, warned us as a society about the emergence of what he called the military-industrial establishment and about the vested interest that that establishment had in continuing to escalate the military dimensions of our society. Well, it seems to me that the Reagan administration, much more consistently than any previous one, determined that there were limits to our resources, and the thing to do was to get the government out of human services and to define the role of the federal government. And this has been expressly stated, I've heard President Reagan state this in news conferences, the primary role of the federal government is defense. And I think that the president would see, and there are people who would agree with him, and I suppose a case could be made for this, that it is good that an increasing percentage of our tax dollars is devoted to military purposes, because that's what the federal government is in fact supposed to do. Its primary function is to defend the people against its enemies. All these other programs, all these other services are to be provided either by the private sector or by local governments and things like that. So it's a philosophic commitment, an ideological commitment, which the present government has committed itself to. And they don't see it as anything of which they should be for which they should be apologetic. I think that the government rightly concluded that the resources of the country are limited and we have to behave politically and in a budgetary way consistent with the limits imposed upon us by reality. But I think what has obviously happened is that these people who have been lobbying for massive increases in defense spending coupled with massive cuts in domestic spending have gained control of the budgetary process and the political process in our country. One of the ways in which this massive increase in federal spending for defense is to be funded is by the massive decrease in federal programs aimed at helping people. And one of the things that that has done is brought together a lot of people who are concerned about the poor, concerned about education, concerned about art, and so forth, with people who are concerned about the escalating arms race. The two are really connected at this economic level. For example, the first budget submitted called for an increase in defense spending of $52 billion, coupled with a decrease in domestic spending of $48 billion. Now, what we should not, whether we agree with this or not, and this is a free country and political disagreements are to be encouraged, but whether we agree with it or not, we should actually see what is happening. What is happening is not that the federal budget is being reduced, but the federal budget is being increased. The only difference is that money which formerly went to such programs as arts, education, human services, is now being transferred to the Pentagon. That's the fact. We can be for that or against that, but we should not obscure that fact. The present budget, which was originally submitted, called for decreases in domestic spending of $27 billion, coupled with increases of $33 billion in defense spending. Well, the programs which were to be cut were in excess of 300 people service programs, some of which were to be eliminated, others of which were to be drastically cut. For example, the budgets proposed a 100% reduction in legal aid services for the poor. In other words, that program of legal aid services was to be eliminated. And I feel that that is an unfortunate thing because our democratic values lead us to believe that every person should have access to legal aid, legal help in time of trouble. If that is not available to a person, then the law does not function in a democratic way. The law functions, which is always the case, even if legal aid services of this sort are available, the law functions in favor of those who have the money to pay for it. But our values as a society and our history as a society lead us to believe that we should strive for as much impartiality in terms of the law as possible, and that can only be, and one way to attain that is to see that everybody has legal services whether they can afford them or not. Also, this is just an example. As I say, over 300 programs were affected by this, and some of them undoubtedly should have been cut. Maybe some of them should have been eliminated. We shouldn't establish a federal program and then just let it go on forever without examining it. But I believe that what we needed was a sort of ice pick approach, and we've had a sledgehammer approach to these problems. There's a lot of truth, though, in the fact that these regulations, these bureaucracies need to be examined, need to be pruned, need to be cut, but they don't necessarily need to be destroyed. 98% of the money that had been appropriated to provide Indian housing on reservations was to be eliminated. 50% reduction in school lunch programs was called for. And you may remember that that was at the time when it was said, as a part of this package, that ketchup should be counted as a vegetable for children in school. Mary McCrory wrote a column on this, and it just happened that when that discussion was going on, Nancy Reagan had served ice cream for one of her parties in which she had sprinkled silver dust. And it was a custom that originated with Indian Maharajas as a way of displaying their wealth, that they would serve their food with silver or gold dust sprinkled upon it. And the contrast between those two things, the debate in the Congress that, in fact, ketchup should count as a vegetable. And that was one of the ways of justifying this 50% reduction in school lunch programs, coupled with the idea that ice cream served with silver was being presented in the White House. Now, this is kind of petty, and I don't mean to put anybody down, but I think it's a question of sensitivities. And we need to heighten, raise our sensitivities. I don't think that Nancy Reagan did that deliberately to insult anybody. It seemed like a nice thing to do, an elegant thing to do. But there is, for me anyway, it's a problem in terms of my moral sensitivity. And it's very much of a footnote. I don't want you to maybe I should leave it out because it distracts you from other things that I want to say. But and I think we're all guilty of those kinds of insensitivities from time to time, so I'm not signaling Nancy Reagan out. But whenever you are in that kind of a position, you have to always expect that that you come under that kind of criticism, and we all have to acknowledge that she's not any different than the rest of us, except that she's the First Lady. Well, the fact is that one of the effects of this massive transfer of funds from people programs to Pentagon programs has been added suffering for the people in our society who are already on the borderline, you see. But if the poor in our society suffer as a result of this transfer of funds, how much more do the poor in the third world, the two-thirds of the world's people who are unable to fill their stomachs, who are permanently hungry? 70% of the world's deaths in any given year, for example, are attributable to malnutrition. 70% of the people who die in the world in any given year would not have died if they had had proper food and proper nourishment. And that doesn't include a whole lot of people in our own nation. But it does include the majority of people in third world nations. A United Nations study on development has recently been completed, and one of the conclusions which that study reached was that the world could either have development or an arms race, but it could not have both because the resources for both were simply not available in the world, nor was the will available to drive both an arms race and a development race. This UN study was reinforced by findings of the Brandt Commission, a commission that came up with the Brandt Report. It was headed by Willy Brandt, the former chancellor of West Germany, and it produced a book called North-South. It was also, this UN finding is reinforced by the studies of such eminent third world economists as Mahbub ul Haq, a Pakistani economist trained in Western liberal economics, and for many years vice president of the World Bank. Robert McNamara, who was president of the World Bank, came up with the same kinds of conclusions. The resources in the world are limited, and they are not adequate to fuel an arms race of this magnitude and development efforts that would be adequate to meet the needs of the world's people. That's why Pope Paul VI and other popes particularly have stated these weapons which we're producing at this cost are already killing millions and hundreds of millions of the world's children by depriving them of the nourishment which they need to sustain their lives. Yeah.
What is that by resources? Are you talking about funds?
Funds, but also human resources. Funds are the most obvious, you know. It isn't only the United States that invests this amount of money in funds, and it isn't only the Soviet Union. More and more the third world nations are getting into this, buying arms and so forth. So the funds are one major component. But also in the United States, for example, and I'll get into this in a moment, 50% or more of all the scientists, research scientists, work for the military, searching for ways of producing more lethal, more accurate weapons, and so on. And 80% of the money which the government invests in research and development is invested in research and development that is military-related. So it's the whole package, but the resources are perhaps the most obvious and the most important. Good. Any other... this is the first dimension of that economics of death, and maybe we can just pause here if there are any other comments or questions. Yeah.
I have a question about President Carter, and it seems to me when he went into presidency, there was a promise that he was going to reduce military spending, and people talk about the conversion of Carter, whereby he seemed to then do a shift. Because he came in, for whatever reasons, he came into confrontation with Soviet mentality, whatever it was, and all of a sudden it started to increase, and I want to know how you explain that. And then secondly, are you asking, you know, let's ignore Reagan for a minute, and his $422 billion, which Schlesinger says is just all fantasy anyhow. He's mad at Reagan because it's all an illusion. He says there's no way the Reagan economy can handle that, okay? But let's just talk about that $170 billion. Are you advocating that we go back to what seems to be the increasing hero, that is Carter, that we go back to $170 billion? I I mean, we're still going to have Poseidons and cruise missiles and B-1 bombers and those kinds of things, which are capable of really eliminating the world. Let's not talk about Reagan, okay? Let's talk about, are you advocating the elimination of nuclear weapons? Are you advocating that we cut that from 170 billion to 20 billion? What are you advocating? Because at 170 billion, we're still gonna have a lot of nuclear weapons running around.
Well, and I'm trying just to describe the reality as I see it at this point, and I don't have any particular thing that I want to advocate. I do have a few things that I want to suggest in a later session, but mostly that's where I want a discussion. I don't think that anybody has the answer to this, what we should do. There are a lot of ideas floating around. One idea in particular that I think makes sense as a first step toward turning this whole dynamic around, namely the idea of a nuclear moratorium. But there is no answer to the problem. I'm just trying to describe the problem in order that against this background, at a later time, we can brainstorm as to what possible directions we might move in. I'm advocating, I will advocate, that we do something which can begin to reverse this momentum. And I will share with you, when we talk about practical actions available to us, that I think the most viable political idea to support right now is the idea of a bilateral nuclear freeze on the production, testing, production, and deployment of nuclear weapons and delivery systems. And I will argue for that at a later time. But that there are many other things that might be suggested as well. That's obviously not adequate. It's only a beginning. It's only an effort to say, let's stop the momentum of this escalation and move from there. The ideas that President Reagan himself has suggested are fine ideas, but the point, the disagreement that I have with him is that in the meantime, while we're trying to work out those ideas, I think it would be better if we didn't keep on escalating what's already going on. We stop it first and then work on these ideas that he has suggested.
Well, it seems in the last 15 years, as a Republican or Democratic administration, their campaign promises are always on moratoriums and freezes and stop of, you know, the buildup. But after they become in Washington, D.C., if it's in the drinking water or what, all of a sudden they want this increased spending. Now, what group? Is it the military-industrial complex that can put this enormous pressure on?
I don't know all the factors that occasion that change. I think one of the things that the Reagan administration has been more successful in than most is sticking to its policies in the face of those kinds of pressures. The fact is, I don't happen to agree with those pressures, but I think it's a model in many respects for that kind of determination. And I would like to see other administrations, frankly, ones that would pursue policies more to my liking, be able to manifest that kind of determination. Dwayne?
I think one of the, talking of that determination, one of the perspectives that's important to just add to this without challenging the basic thrust that's there is that you've been talking in terms of budgets and not in terms of appropriations. And I always get the sense that people are going to think, number one, that the Reagan budget proposal is the law of the land, mm-hmm. and it isn't. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that most of the increases in the out years, in the first year, in this particular budget, that passed, that Reagan was able to get through with such great skill and such determination, only the, you know, the first steps were kind of laid for that. The shift, in fact, has not been as massive at this point. It's what's projected to be shifted in future budgets. That's extremely important. I say that only to suggest that what we are only to add that what we are already seeing is a major resistance that is developing to the second and third and fourth years of that, especially since what the Congress did and in its wisdom was to adopt the principles of the Reagan budget and the principles of the Reagan tax cut and keep some of the domestic spending in there so that we are now down the road facing a major confrontation, I think, in the next 3 or 4 years over where the money is going to come from.
Well, thank you for that. I have deliberately presented the budget proposals of the Reagan administration because I think it's on the basis of those proposals that we can see most clearly where this administration intends to take the country. But it is true that in terms both of the Republican and the Democratic membership of Congress, there has been resistance to that, to those proposals. There has not, I mean, in general, though, there has not been very massive cuts by Congress in terms of the requested amounts for defense that were submitted. And according to the congressman who spoke to us at this conference in Washington, there will not be any kind of significant resistance in Congress to these military increases unless there is resistance among the people and unless the people express themselves. Les Aspin, who's a representative from Wisconsin, for example, said that every congressman that he knows, the first he begins his day or she begins her day by going to her office and finding, looking at the chart that charts how many letters have been received for or against a particular measure. And if there's a large outpouring one way or the other, that's the way the congressperson votes. So and he said, in Congress, the mood on defense flips 180 degrees every 40 days, according to what the headlines of the newspapers say. The Russians invade Afghanistan, everything's thrown out the window, and we start over again. He said, that's no way to plan a rational defense program for the country. He said, there will not be a rational defense program for the country until the people take an interest in this and until there is a solid constituency calling for restraint, a constituency which does not evaporate every time the Russians do something that is threatening.
There are people in Congress that respond that way. It is true that they, like us, are fearful of the Russians, and that, you know, when these things happen, I don't argue with your conclusions, but I don't think that's the first thing a congressman does as a generalization in the morning.
Well, there's some, apparently,
it's metaphorical sense,
who do that. I'm glad. Thank you. If I'm giving false, I'm only repeating what the congressman told us. And I'm sure that there are congressmen who make decisions on certain issues in that.
I don't think Lowell Erdahl's brother does that.
Right.
I hope not.
I would like to mention another factor that I think is happening that we're not always aware of. I think when budget issues come up, you know, we hear about those, we look at where budget cuts are being made, but I think there are some very subtle things being done in our government at this time that will affect the budgets. And that's changes being made very subtly in legislation where mandates are being taken away for human service programs so that once these are passed, funds are no longer needed. And so instead of taking the funds away and dismantling the programs that way, they take the law mandates away so that funds are no longer necessary. They're restraining things. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's very important in the human service areas and laws that are affecting human services to keep close watch on what bills are coming up so that we can get those letters into congressmen as those issues are coming up before them, because I don't think it is possible for congressmen to keep up on all the little ramifications of minor changes in laws.
The problem of a democratic society seems to me it requires a constituency, a political constituency, that is informed and makes efforts to keep itself informed, and also a political constituency that is involved. And so many realities in our modern world militate against that kind of a constituency. So much of our life turns us into passive spectators, and we need to be actively involved in politics if we're going to maintain our democratic way of life. We need to be involved in a way that is informed. And it's hard to keep track of all those kinds of things, but that's what happens. We begin to educate ourselves when we come together in groups like this and discuss these things. One of the taboos of our society, you know, is don't discuss politics and religion. And if we don't break that taboo, how are we ever going to become informed or involved, either in terms of religion or politics? There are a couple people.
Just to add, human service, in a way, I feel we, our democratic society, where it is, I think it's great. It's really new, but it's probably the most inefficient one ever conceived. There's no doubt. But our tax dollars are just, so many of them are just plain wasted. And I think we got the government doing what our churches and we should be doing. I think we look at these things and it's, I know definitely that
the money we give to the church or to our missionaries and so forth is used so much more efficiently than the dollars we give to our government. And if we as Christians would, in a way, look at that as one way of where we allow the government to take over our responsibility. And I really feel that. One of the things we can do is
I'm getting a little nervous. I've got some information for you that I think is valuable. And a lot of these things that are coming up would fit better at a future session. They're all very important questions, but if we don't get back on the track, I'm not going to have a chance to give you any of this stuff. And maybe it's not worth anything, but I spent a lot of time collecting this information. Is that okay if we go on a little bit? To summarize this first dimension of the economic dynamics of death, we simply have a situation in which an increasing proportion of the world's resources, human and otherwise, are being channeled to promote the world's most sophisticated weapons of destruction. And in the meantime, human needs are less and less adequately funded. But there's another dimension to this that's more difficult to see, although it's not that hard once we begin to think about it. It's a dynamic that's been uncovered by people like Seymour Melman, who's an industrial engineer for Princeton University. You know, the myth has gotten around in our society. There are lots of myths in our society, but one myth is that a large amount of money spent for arms creates prosperity in the society. And our people believe that. People are afraid that if we stop spending so much money, in fact, we'll lose jobs and the whole economy will collapse. I think Melman has shown that myth arose because of the fact that after the Great Depression, the Second World War and arms spending did, in fact, effectively bring the Depression to an end. But he's shown that sustained expenditure on arms, in fact, is very undermining to the health of a nation's economy. And there are several reasons for that. One reason, quite a few of the dimensions of this have to do with the fact that very high levels of spending on arms is extremely inflationary. Inflationary for a number of reasons. One is that it gets the law of supply and demand out of kilter. As you know, one of the fundamental laws of economics, and I'm not an economist, just like Walter Storr is not a physicist, but I read a little bit about this. And I think it's a question too important to be left to the economists. One of the basic laws of economics is that the greater the supply of an article in the society, the lower the price. The higher the demand, the higher the price. What, in fact, we're doing in our society when we pump $422 billion, and I'm sure that won't be the final figure, but that's what the administration would like, into the economy to produce arms and other things related to the military, is that we create a lot of money to be spent on goods and services in the society. But all those people who are receiving this money and spending it are not producing any supply of goods for the economy. So there's a large demand created by that money being pumped in, and yet no goods is being supplied in return for that amount of money. It's very inflationary for that reason. Another reason that it's inflationary is a little bit more subtle. We complain that we can't compete on the world market with Germany and Japan and Switzerland and other nations. And the fact is that American productivity is declining, that the cost of producing goods is increasing in America, that the goods that are produced are not as good as some of those things produced in Japan and Germany. One of the reasons for that is that in our concentration on producing the world's most sophisticated military technology, we have neglected to improve our civilian technologies, our technologies for steel making, for automotive making, for automobile making, those kinds of things. We have invested, as I said, something like $100 billion in research and development, the government has, since the Second World War. 80% of which has been invested to create new weapon systems. The Japanese and the Germans have invested a proportionately similar amount of their gross national product in research and development, almost all of which has been invested to improve civilian technologies. And that begins to take hold, to take an effect after a while. I've heard our senator from South Dakota argue that we ought to make the Japanese, and I think this is a good good logic to this. We ought to make the Japanese spend more on defense because in that way we would undermine their economy for one thing, and it's only fair that they spend more money anyway, and their economy would be weakened and they would be less competitive on the world market. But the ironic thing is that the same people who make that argument will also, at a different audience, argue that we have to invest lots of money in arms spending because it creates prosperity in our nation. They argue on the one hand that the reason that the German and the Japanese economies are so strong is that they don't have to invest all this money in arms. But on the other hand, they argue that if we want to have a strong economy, we have to invest a lot of money in arms. And the problem is that two and two in that case don't make four. They come out to some other figure. I believe that Melman is correct when he says that that the result of concentrating our efforts on improving military technology is to cause this kind of decline in our civilian technology, and therefore to make our goods less competitive with the goods of other nations on the world market. And that, of course, creates problems for our economy. Also, maintaining these bases all over the world is very expensive, and it causes problems in the balance of payments, and the balance of, particularly in the balance of payments. The money which we pay our troops in Germany, in Japan, and other places goes primarily into the German economy, not into our economy. And even though over most of the years since the Second World War, we have had very favorable balance of trade, that is, we've sold more products on the world market than we've bought, during many of those same years, our balance of payments has been in the negative, partly because of the immense cost of maintaining these bases, these far-flung bases all over the world. So there are lots of reasons why the, and that's created pressure on the dollar, it's made the dollar less strong in relationship to other currencies. One other thing that I'll mention in this respect, the second dimension of the economics of debt, is that the myth that military spending creates jobs is also a myth. That is, it's not a myth if there's enough dollars to invest in all the domestic programs that we want to invest in, plus dollars left to invest in guns. But if we invest money in guns by transferring it from education or from other social programs, generally the end result is to cost jobs. Calculations have shown, and the figures vary on this, but they're always in the same direction, that $1 billion invested by the government in education would create 118,000 jobs. But if the government invested that same money to build the B-1 bomber, it would create only 58,000 jobs. So if we transfer $1 billion from education to B-1 bomber, we're actually costing the society between 50 and 60,000 jobs. The reason for that, well, you can see the reason. How big a salary do people in the education sector get? But when we're talking about B-1 bomber, we have to pay a lot of very high salaried skilled workers, research scientists. Also, the materials out of which those B-1 bombers are created are very expensive. There's also a great deal of waste and higher levels of profits in military contracts than in most civilian contracts, about 10% higher for because of the principles on the basis of which military contracts, for the most part, are signed. So I think it is a myth to think that if military spending is funded by transferring funds from civilian programs, it creates jobs for the society. I think it is a myth to think that in the long run, over a long period of time, large outlays for military purposes actually help the economy. I believe they undermine the economy. Now, we may say that in spite of that cost, that economic cost to the society, we have to continue doing that because of the Russians. But I think the fact is that it's not healthy for our economy. And I think there's rather widespread consensus among economists about this, although different economists would argue with regard to how significant that effect is and how significant it is in relationship to other factors which undermine the economy. None that I know of would deny that it has, over the long run, a negative effect. One of the problems that the Israeli economists are beginning to discuss is the problem created in Israel for the economy by the fact that Israel has to have such an enormous defense outlay. 100% inflation is tied partly to that fact. Okay, well, let me go very quickly over that's a little bit of a description of the economics of debt. Let me just summarize very briefly what I call the politics of debt and the psychology of debt. Part of the politics of debt has to do with the fact that these weapons which we produce are used partly, not only to defend us against the Russians. That is, of course, true. And many of us who fear the Russians are reluctant to lay down all of our weapons at one full fell swoop. That's why we promote a bilateral freeze on nuclear weapons rather than a unilateral one. Although, as David Price has pointed out, there are many things that either side could do unilaterally to get the thing going that would not jeopardize the society that much. But that's another kind of discussion. The politics of death has to do with the fact that a lot of this weapon system is used to support regimes in the third world which are favorable to us, to the economic interests of our society, and also to our political interests. Our concern is not necessarily that those governments govern their nations in the interests of their own people, but that they provide for us. They pursue policies which allow us access to the raw materials and the markets in those systems, and that they become a part of our economic and political systems. And in country after country, El Salvador, particularly in Latin America, we have governments that were put in power by United States involvement and are kept there by United States supplying them with weapons. And of course, the nuclear threat that we have backs the whole system up. Actually, serious discussions have been had in government circles about the use of nuclear weapons in third world situations, Korea and elsewhere. Came within a hair's breadth, many believe, of using nuclear weapons in a number of situations of that sort. The Pentagon admits that. It says that it must be prepared to fight a war and a half at all times. The war is with Russia, the half war is with the third world. The new doctrine is that we must be prepared to fight many wars simultaneously, one with the Russians, others with any place in the third world or elsewhere in the world that would get out of hand. Brown stated this when he was Secretary of Defense. Our economy, he said, has come to depend heavily on imports of energy supplies and raw materials, and 9% of our GNP now results from the sale of U.S. goods and services abroad. So we have to maintain economic access to those societies. And part of our defense establishment is for that purpose. Michael Clare, who works for the Institute for Policy Studies, has said that up to 22% of our defense budget in any year is really for that purpose, namely to not against the Russians at all, but against these other possibilities, and to enable us to intervene in those situations. That's the politics of death. And I could go on more, but I'm going to take two or three more minutes, so we'll have some time at the end for discussion. Again, we had some of our discussion during the process, and that's why I'm not quite as feeling under as much pressure as I would have otherwise been. But there is a psychological effect to this death machine that is being created, this machine of this enormous capacity. And there are people, particularly psychologists, in the area of death and dying who are uncovering that. I think that, in fact, the presence of the bomb, the reality of the bomb, affects all of our psyches more than we're aware of if we dig down into our subconscious. I have friends, relatives, who've had dreams about the bomb. I think there's a sense of dis-ease, disorientation that is produced in all of us. I've had friends who wanted to do simulation games with their youth groups in churches, and the youth groups just refused to do it. They said, why should we simulate the future? There's no future for us. 86% of our population believe there'll be a nuclear war in their time. Over 50% believe that they will not survive it. Polls have shown. Now, that kind of feeling is bound to affect our psyche. And it's bound to affect our behavior. This man by the name of Edwin Schneidman, who teaches for UCLA and Harvard, has done some research with his students. And he's uncovered some of the ways in which their psyches are affected. He's come to the conclusion, and I could give you some quotes from these students, who attribute some of their antisocial behavior to their resentment that there may not be any future for them. We always treat the symptoms of drugs and sex and alcohol and all this, but we don't treat the causes. And Schneidman and others believe that one of the causes, it would be foolish for me to say the only cause, but one of the causes is this awareness that we may be living at the end of time, and that the sky could just collapse on us at any moment. But I just want to share with you the conclusions to which Schneidman has come. He said, since the bomb and its successors in death technology, the new possibility of total death for the species has become a reality. As a result, he said, there has emerged in the human species what he called a thanatological aura, a death aura, that comes from the old Greek word thanatos. We are all victimized to some extent by this thanatological aura of our time. And in concluding, he points out that this is in fact a theological, a spiritual issue, an issue of pastoral concern to Christians. He says, where is that quote? He says, quote, in concluding his study, he says, "We are at a fulcrum time in the psychological history of the human race, vibrating in mid-deep, debating whether to sink into the speechless profound of the sea or to bound up into the blessed air, whether to respond to the imperious call of life," which I, as a Christian and a theologian, would say is God's call, whether to respond to the imperious call of life or to succumb to the constant invitation that death seductively puts forth. And that really leads us into the subjects that I want to deal with in the next two sessions, which are religious subjects, theological, biblical subjects. This is the dilemma, this is the question with which the nuclear age confronts us: to be or not to be, to live or to die, light or darkness. And I believe those questions are essentially spiritual questions, theological questions. They are precisely the questions with which the Bible at its heart seeks to deal, with which the Christian faith at its heart seeks to deal. And we want to try to uncover those themes from the Scriptures that deal with that profound spiritual issue that is raised for us by the presence of the bomb in our age. Okay, we have about 5 minutes. Yes, yes. And I really am sorry that I cut you off in this discussion. It was not because the quality of the questions was not good. It was simply because I had a burden to share, and whether it was worth anything to you or not, I feel like I've delivered it. So tonight, we can pursue this further. Perhaps some of this information will help us in our forum tonight.
What time?
It's at 9, I believe, the forum. We have still five minutes, though, if some of you want to.
How does the tax cut and the philosophy of supply-side economics affecting us, that the parent that's supposed to create more money in the system, but it's all going to the
Well, I'm not sure that I understand supply-side economics. I think it simply means that if there's more money in the economy, I mean, I'm not sure what it means, but I think maybe it'll work and maybe it won't. We'll just have to wait and see. Anybody want to shed some light on supply-side economics? Isn't it sort of based on the trickle-down theory?
I don't understand either. I'm not sure if it fits in here.
Well, I think it fits into the extent that the administration would say its solution to these problems of social justice is supply-side economics. And hopefully the private sector will take care of that. The kind of question which this gentleman raised, and which I hope we will discuss at a later session. Ed?
Knowing that you have such good statistics on economic growth and spending, can you give us the statistics on how the social part of the budget has grown from 45 to 80? That's probably been the most significant budget change, been the growth of social programs from 45 to 80.
Like, oh, you mean from 1945 to 1980?
Yeah, and I'd like to hear some kind of recitation of those statistics also, since that's been the dominant change in American budgeting, much more than the changes in percentages of military spending.
Well,
I'd like to hear an equivalent kind of interpretation of that.
I can't give you that. Yes? I wonder if you'd explain what the applause meant, those of you that applauded.
I may be very naive, but I can't see where everything is so bad. I see things that are happening in my state of Iowa that would never have social things that are going on that would never have been 20, 40 years ago. And I see things that are happening in our hospitals and in our welfare.
Yeah. Well, some of these things are the result of the volunteerist dimension of our society, which I think is to be applauded. President Reagan's call for more volunteerism in our society, who can be opposed to that? Some of these things are undoubtedly in jeopardy if all the funding cuts that are proposed actually go into effect. many of these programs may not be able to continue. Yes.
Are leaving in about, you know, 5 years. Can you give us kind of a, what are you really driving at after all the theological? Kind of a little summary, but.
Okay, my point in the theological presentations will be that I believe at the heart of our calling as Christians is to be concerned about the welfare of fellow human beings on this earth, that the way we have of serving God, since God doesn't need any service directly, is to serve our fellow human beings, to speak a decisive no against anything in history, in reality, which we see threatening human beings, human welfare. That's our way of serving God. And I want to refer to a number of biblical passages, and specifically those that have to do with war and with the idolatry of the state and other kinds of things that reinforce that idea which I want to present. But I first wanted us to see what the problem was before we try to bring our faith to bear upon it. And I may be wrong in approaching it from that perspective, but I do think we have to have information. I think we have to be, like Jesus said, as wise as serpents. We have to know what our world is like before we try to prescribe for it. The question that Ed asked would be right on there, but I don't know the answer to it. I would question whether or not that, I mean, I think equally significant and equally unprecedented is the amount of money which has been devoted to military purposes in our society since the Second World War. That is something totally unprecedented, in very much the same way as these social programs are totally unprecedented. And I think we must always couple those two things. We never had, and in fact, our founding fathers were committed to the idea that we should not have a standing military of any size, because they believed, on the basis of their knowledge of history, that that jeopardized the democratic process which they were so committed to preserving. So the first time in our history that we had a military, standing military of any significant size, or invested any significant sums of money on a continuing basis in the military was from the time of the Second World War on. At the same time, we were developing all these social programs. And I think both of those should be analyzed side by side.
The other thing I think we get away from in doing this economic kind of study is we forget that every one of those missiles on the Trident that goes into Seattle in a couple of weeks, every one of those is worth 5 to 10 times one atom bomb. We saw the effects of the atom bomb last night in that film. It was just terrible. And there are 408 of those missiles in one of those submarines. And I don't care if you want to compare social programs or not. I don't want to be in a world where there's that much power and destruction.
Mm-hmm. Okay, listen, let's keep together as a group if we can. And this is what democracy is about. This is what we believe in our society. The opportunity to come together and search for the truth. No one of us has the truth all complete. We're searching for the truth. So let's see what kind of clarity we can come up with by the end of our time together here. Lowell?
Just one comment before we go. For those of you who believe in frustration, don't forget Golden Village has one of the most magnificent taping services in the whole world. You can get the rest of those tapes. You can get the tape that I did the other day on A New Look at War, and the one that I plan to do tomorrow on A New Look at Alternatives to War. There are many others in the catalog of their tapes. I hope that if you're concerned about this, wherever you may look at this, you'll be open to listen to the debate on all sides and take advantage of that great and very economical service.
I share your concern, your frustration, because I have not said anything yet of what I really want to say. I've only been preparing to say it. And so if you think you'd like to hear the tapes, fine. If not, that's okay too. Yes, Ed?
One kind of interesting fact for me on the Department of Energy, we have a group in our church that debates us all the time. It's a guy who was head of the energy department for the Northwest, and a guy who was executive for Chevron, okay, and one small group kind of discussing this. And the guy who was head of the Department of Energy, Chevron was knocking him for the profits. He says, the cumulative profits of the energy department before it was dismantled was higher than all the combined profits of their oil companies. Knowing that those profits are hidden too. Knowing, okay. And the guy from the energy department says, yeah, I'm aware of that. He says, but we're responsible for all the nuclear development.
And the guy from Chevron says, yeah, but even after you eliminate that, your profits are, were still, your cost for the energy department was still higher than all the combined profits of the oil companies. To which the guy from the energy department said, yes, I'm aware of that. The guy from the energy department was interesting, was head of the whole thing, wasn't really upset that that department, which had just grown, that is the perfect example of a huge bureaucracy that just blew way out of control.
Right.
Which again, somebody's got to, I mean, if there's been any, again, another major theme that has hurt our economy has been this monstrous growth of federal government. It's just an utterly devastating to our economy. It's not just defense, but it's a whole growth of federal bureaucracy. That too's got to be brought under control.
Right.
Such as the
But we mustn't pit ourselves against one another, those of us that are concerned about this military escalation against those who are concerned about the burgeoning of governmental bureaucracy in other areas. We must work together because these two things are two dimensions of the same problem.
Yes.